Critically Linked, How Books of the Past Shape Our Future, a DiscourseNet podcast with Dana Triff and Jaspal Singh.
Hi, my name is Dana Triff and...
My name is Jaspal Singh.
And this is the first episode of hopefully many from our newly launched podcast, Critically Linked, How Past Books Shape Our Futures. The podcast wants to bring back to the table old and new philosophers while asking at the same time how relevant their ideas still are when dealing with contemporary problems. Together with us are today Michael Klanert, lecturer in sociolinguistics at the University of Southampton, England, and as he describes himself, a dedicated teacher of, among others, philosophy. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me. Yes, being a philosophy teacher is a former life now, but brought back memories of teaching Kant, so I'm happy to discuss it.
Andrew Jones is our next guest, and Andrew is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Exeter and currently working on a book on Kantian thought and biology. Is that correct, Andrew?
Thank you for having me, yes. So I've just finished the book. The book is currently under production at the University of Wales Press. It's called How Kant Matters for Biology. And I've recently changed jobs as well. So I'm now an impact fellow at the University of Exeter. And my job is to understand, map, and promote knowledge exchanges across the School of Social Science and International Studies. So thank you for having me.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, Michael. So before we delve into the main topics of our discussion today, we should mention that our old philosopher is, of course, Immanuel Kant. But it is an Immanuel Kant seen through the lenses of Charles Wade Mills.
Charles Mills was a Jamaican professor of philosophy at the Graduate Center, City University of New York. He also taught for a great number of years at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Born in 1951, Mills was educated first in Jamaica and then in Canada, where he graduated with a PhD in philosophy from the University of Toronto. Unfortunately, Mills passed away last year. He has left us his writings, that is his books and articles, in which he discusses and criticizes older philosophical currents such as Marxism or Kantian liberalism, but also the newer schools of Black radicalism and racial liberalism.
So the twin issues of personhood and recognizability have been a thread throughout Mills' writings and teachings. His readings of older philosophies and philosophers through these lenses have led him to develop his own thinking, and he has advocated, among others, the reappropriation of Western liberal concepts from a Black viewpoint. So I just want to mention here something from our article that we are, of course, discussing today. It was published in 2018, and Mills here tried to develop what he called a Black radical Kantianism.
In the article, Mills talks about how feminists and Marxists have appropriated Kantian ideas, and he suggests that Black radical thought can do the same. Quote, an analogous Black radical appropriation of Kant should draw on the distinctive social ontology and view of the state associated with the Black radical tradition. In ethics, this would mean working with a color-conscious rather than color-blind social ontology of white persons and Black sub-persons, and then asking what respect for oneself and others would require under those circumstances. In political philosophy, it would mean framing the state as a Rassenstaat, a racial state, and then asking what measures of corrective justice would be necessary to bring out the ideal Rechtsstaat or justice state, unquote.
Now, after this very, very brief introduction of Mills, I really want to provoke you and I want to ask you, what do you think that respect for oneself and respect for others require when working, for example, with what Mills calls a color conscious rather than colorblind social ontology?
I mean, I think that the first thing to kind of understand is what kind of Kantianism Mills is trying to develop here. So it seems to be one in which he views Kant's account of the ontological theory of rights as good, you know, something to be saved. Yes. So the idea is that the problem of other accounts which have come before Mills is that they try to explain away, you know, they accept that Kant's personal views were racist, and they try to explain away those racist views. Yeah. And they think that's a way of getting to this idea of the Reichstag. Yeah. And it seems that what Mills is suggesting is that we need to also engage in a historical account of Kant's personal views. So in that sense, you know, we can't just assume that explaining race away will undo the historical damage of racism, to which Kant was, you know, at the very least as a person involved in. Yeah. And then I think it's open for discussion whether Kant's broader account of philosophy of right is also racist or not. Yeah. So I think that's the sense. So I think that I would probably be more inclined to suggest that the whole Kantian account of right should be examined under the gaze of this sense of, you know, to what extent is reason as a model for society itself racist, which I don't think that Mills shares.
Yeah, if you excuse me, Andrew, so just to, I think it's very hard for us in a way, those who have been educated in this Western liberal tradition, to imagine Kant as a racist. We tend to think of him as the philosopher of the categorical imperative, conceptualizing a universality, of allowing us to think in universal terms. And at the same time, interspersed throughout his writings, we have these racist references that embarrass us a little bit, right? So I think that the idea of respect, of thinking that we first have to reconsider the basis for our universality is quite, I wouldn't say an intriguing thought, because it has been around for some time, but it is something that we have to engage with every time that we go back to these older writings. Michael, what do you think? What would be your take on this matter?
Two things to think about. One is what happens in Kantian thought, and one is how you try and analyze reality nowadays and how you can then apply it. And I think Mills does both things in his text. So if you look at Kant, his argument would be that that Kant's universalism is actually not that universal. It's actually quite limited to, and racist to one group and then subgroups. And the way we used to deal with this is just to forget that bit of the anthropology, which is, of course, not very philosophical and not very Kantian either, because Kant would always argue that the anthropology is the basis of ethics. So you can't just say, oh, let's leave your anthropology out and let's just take your universalist ethics, because your anthropology quite clearly, in from my view nowadays, is not universalist, because it cuts out a big part of humanity. That's the one question you need to ask. And the other question, and I think that's the question of respect, and that's also what actually Mills brought to me, because I haven't engaged much in thinking about racism before in that way, is to think about what my position as a sort of white male and the norm around this, and just to think, well, this is you know, my life is normal and everybody else's life is roughly the same, and if you start thinking about this critically and carefully, you realize, well, it's not, and it still is not, and we are still living in a situation of a Rassenstaat in many respects. And therefore, even if we cut out Kant's racist bit and say, okay, let's just say we take this the basic anthropology of all humans, and we don't take race into account in the first step, and therefore take the categorical imperative. If we apply this to the empirical situation, and that's how I understand Mills, is we need to understand that we are not all the same, that we are not starting from the same original position, that we haven't had the same rights for centuries, and that gives us a different position in today's society, and therefore there's some question of redistributive justice to be dealt with. And I think that's what we should pack into the idea of respect, recognizing the different history, acknowledging it, because I'm German, and looking at the German background, we're not very good at acknowledging it. It's very much sort of a limitation of, oh, this racism happened in the 12 years, in these 12 awful years, and actually not thinking about the long line of history that's behind it and how we have been involved in colonialism in the same way as everybody else. That recognition is the first step to respect for oneself and others, I would argue.
Yeah, no, thank you. I think what Michael said was really important, that we become color conscious, that we don't explain away Kant's racist views, for instance, or other philosophers' racist views of that time. We understand that not only has this time been a time where racism was sort of normalized, but in fact that these kinds of philosophies justified racism to some degree through the category of reason, perhaps, right? And reason was only something that white and male subjects could possess. So in some ways, it was not only racism, it was also sexism that was justified through these philosophies. And Andy said something earlier that reason itself is racist. So I would like to invite Andy to sort of to elaborate on this a bit.
Yeah, so I guess we're talking about it from like different ends. So we're talking about reason as being for the privileged few, in a sense, you know, so for white male individuals at a certain contextual time. I mean, the problem which I see is that reason is universalized, even though it's specific to a certain, you know, kind of European culture. And I don't, so we were talking about, you know, in addition to racism, there's also sexism in Kant. There's also kind of Kant's, I work on Kant and religion. I used to work in a theology and religion department. And I think that we can look at his philosophy of religion as a similar way of how he tries to develop an account of religion which is compatible with reason. So Kant basically says that he wants to preserve those aspects of religion that are compatible with reason, and he tries to re-explain the ecclesiastical practices of religion only insofar as they are promoting some rational aim. So he argues, for instance, in Religion Within the Bounds of Bare Reason, that prayer should be a time for contemplation rather than asking for something for free, and that the Eucharist is an activity to essentially kind of consolidate communities rather than thinking that you're eating the blood and the body of Christ. And in a sense, you know, this is partially a defense against the abuse of power from clergy and church fathers. So he realizes that they may be, you know, telling people to do something which stands against morality and reason. But it also denies, you know, authentic religious experience to many individuals. So if you compare that with, say, Kierkegaard's discussion of Abraham being told to kill Isaac, that's a glorification of God's test on Abraham to act against God's own commandments because of faith. And that doesn't fit into a Kantian model. So I think in that sense, you know, when we apply reason as the universal standard under which we should understand other cultures, it takes away, well, it may take away from the authentic experience of those cultures, you know, so we don't recognize their cultural practices in terms of their own authentic relationship to that culture, but instead only as a contribution to reason.
We introduced the concept of the Rassenstaat, yeah, and the Rechtsstaat, and maybe we should approach it a little bit. So what does he mean by the Rechtsstaat? Of course, this is Kant's notion and concept that Mills then reinterprets, and he says, well, it is a Rechtsstaat. Citizens are bound by the rule of law, but who are the citizens and how does Kant define the citizens? And we see that there are exclusions. Yeah? And Andy just mentioned sexism in Kantian writings, and women are certainly not, or they were not at the time part of the polity. They were not citizens. They were supposed to be, according to Kant, guarded, yeah, under guardianship. So certainly not part of the Rechtsstaat. That is why, in practical terms, Mill says Kantian politics is about the Rassenstaat, and we have to deal with this reality before deciding how actually we can correct these imbalances, and then try to live out very practically Kantian universalism. So in that vein, I was thinking maybe I should provoke you again to think a little bit this Rechtsstaat, Rassenstaat. How can we approach them from the point of view of Mill's Afro-modernity? He talks about Afro-modernity, he talks about Euro-modernity. What can Black radical thinking, Black political thought, help us achieve, you know, when we approach these two concepts?
I mean, I think the difference between Rassenstaat and Reichsstaat in this sense is that it is that sense that one is historicized. So in my own work, I investigate Kant's influence on the development of biology, especially in the British Isles, how his ideas helped to form science generally, but biology specifically in the British Isles, because it had been done in Germany already. And I draw from those debates. But something which I find very kind of compatible with Mill's approach is that there's that sense that philosophy has a tendency to ignore history. And the solution is, you know, to explain away the historical kind of suffering in this case, which has been caused by racism and racist views, whether they are just based on the personal contextual milieu or whether there's something which is more embedded in philosophy more generally. But it does seem that what this idea of Afro-modernity is doing is it's giving a particular perspective on modernity from the African perspective, which is talking about their personal story of suffering because of injustices against their personhood, from Mill's perspective, that, you know, we are all persons in the ontological sense. And then that level of personhood is stripped away from us through the particular political institutions and the injustices that they promote.
I want to give you the floor, Andrew. I was just thinking maybe we should mention an incident in which Whoopi Goldberg, an African-American actress, was involved with. It happened in February this year, and Whoopi Goldberg, she's of course very well known, and she hosts her own ABC show, The View. And in this political show, Goldberg, together with several other guests, women, they were discussing the withdrawing of books such as graphic novel Maus by Art Spiegelman and Pulitzer Prize winning To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee from two schools' required reading lists. One was in Tennessee and respectively in Washington State. And Goldberg first said during the panel discussion that, quote, "This is white people doing it to white people," when referring to the Holocaust. But towards the end of the discussion, she comes back and clarifies quite emphatically that, quote, "The Holocaust is not about race. It is about men's inhumanity to men, and men," inverted commas, of course, "could be anyone, irrespective of the color of his or her skin." So she received quite a bit of criticism for her comments, and she later publicly apologized on Twitter. "I stand corrected," she was quoted saying. And yet this controversy, right, of the Holocaust being a white people's affair and not really involving race, I think it's important to discuss it a little bit, because from my perspective, at least, what Goldberg seems to be defending was a particular type of universalization that somehow does away with race. Yeah? It's not about race, the Holocaust, it's about men being awful, men being at their worst. And this sort of interpretation of the Holocaust does away with race in a way that Mill's critique points out has been mirrored by major schools of thought, yeah, such as the one we are currently discussing, Kantian liberalism, and which Mills is trying to reinterpret as Black Kantian liberalism. What would you make of it?
I was thinking of coming back to Andy's point about philosophers having a tendency to be ahistorical, and specifically the Kantian type, because the idea, of course, of these pure rules and pure reason is this is something a priori, right? This is something that is not historical. And only later on we need to bring the historical back. And I think Mills tries to do something similar in a way, because he on the one hand, he says, well, the anthropology is flawed and we need to address that. And there are results of that anthropology that we need to address, but the rules in the middle we can still use. And there's still the categorical imperative is still something valid and a solid grounding for ethics, but we need to adapt it to the empirical reality. Now, the empirical reality is the difficulty here, right? The whole debate about what race is and how we should deal with racism, because you can open this up in all sorts of directions, right? Whether you say we should abolish the idea of race totally because it's a biological nonsense, or whether we still need it to address the social results caused by the social category. And that's where the whole problem starts. And actually, to an extent, that the term Rassenstaat would not be used by a German philosopher. They wouldn't use the term Rasse at all. Actually, recently, there's a book come out, Zurkamp, about the philosophy of race, where they say in the preface, we are not using the word Rasse because it has a different connotation from the English word race. And you think, yeah, but shouldn't we in German also reappropriate that term and make aware of the tensions of that term? To also point out what actually happened in the Holocaust, and that had a long-standing tradition back to German colonialism, back to the trial of concentration camps in the German colonies, and the categorization of humans as subhuman that then can be treated in that way. So it is. It is interesting that this is not only a sort of something that happens in the US, is in a similar way you see this in the German discourse, and possibly in the UK in a different way.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned this particular example, because I think Mills also in his article discusses this connection between Nazi Germany actually and racism in the United States, and kind of shows that it was a learning behavior, that the Nazis also learned it from somewhere, and we cannot ignore these conversations and just position ourselves somehow outside. Yeah, and he also says it's very difficult for, I don't want to say us, I mean, trying to impersonate Mills right now, it would create another distinction between us and them. But for the sake of the argument, he also says it's very difficult for Afro-modernity or Afro-modern Black thought to position itself towards or against Euro modernity, because we are so interlinked. What is hegemony and what is counter-hegemony? We are very much present in each other's realities, right? The colonialist thinking, or the thinking of our philosophers, of Western philosophers, incorporating these colonial realities. And at the same time, the reaction, of course, coming from the Black community, trying to process their own position within this hegemonic Western thinking. And it is a very intimate connection, and it is much harder to distinguish, says Mills, than, for example, when we are discussing Asian traditions of political thought compared to European traditions of political thought. To come back, in a sense, to the controversy created by Whoopi Goldberg and our discussion, just very bluntly, right? Can we still follow today's Kant's categorical imperative? What do you think?
I mean, it depends what we mean by Kant's categorical imperative, right? So I think the way that Kant is taught, at say, basic undergraduate level, is that you have three general theories of ethics. You know, so you have virtue ethics by Aristotle, utilitarianism by Mill and Bentham, and then you have deontology by Kant. And the sense is you get presented with a lot of different thought experiments, and you try and figure out whether they would be ethically permissible or not under the different frameworks. And that feels like a bit of a basic way to approach ethics in a sense, you know. So I would, the way that I approach Kant's ethics is that the categorical imperative is really a way of sifting out what can be considered as falling within the domain of morality. Yeah. So he's not saying that anything which can't be justified under the categorical imperative is necessarily immoral. It's just that it's not appropriate to talk about it in terms of morality. And what he means by that, I think, or what I think he means by that, is not that we are unable to understand what's better or worse to do in those situations, but it's more that we can never pat ourselves on the back for doing either situation. So with the trolley problem that has been spoken about, you know, for any undergraduate ethics degree, you know, whether you keep a train or trolley going on a path that hits five people, or you change it and it hits one person. And basically the argument against deontological ethics is that you're not allowed to change the track because you're actively deciding to kill another person, which you know, kill one rather than five, which goes against the rule of not killing people. But I take it that a Kantian probably would change the track. They just wouldn't feel that they'd done the right thing, you know, because they'd be going, there is no right thing to do in this situation. So in that sense, you know, maybe we can still follow the categorical imperative in a sense of developing some maxims for ourselves that we aim to achieve, but we also recognize that in many situations, we don't really know if we're following those imperatives. So in the groundwork to the Metaphysics of Morals, for instance, Kant goes on to say that we never really know whether we're acting in accordance with our sense of duty or whether we're acting through some other kind of reason, which is closer to our own inclinations. Yeah. So there's that sense that we never really know that our action is coming from a morally justified place. So yeah, I'll leave it there.
I mean, this is the other thing I found interesting, that there's a small bit in the Mills where he talks about white people writing about whiteness and the sort of revelation for themselves that they for quite a long time in their lives haven't thought about this, or in their everyday life don't realize how they categorize the world. And I felt a bit the same when I thought about Mills. That, you know, we are in our sort of privileged environments and deal with so many other things every day that we often lose track of this. And that reflexivity is quite a difficult one to achieve, to remember where things came from, but also to find a way to fix them. I mean, this is the other question. I mean, he comes up with these, again, fairly abstract modifications of the categorical imperative, but that doesn't take us much further in actually addressing the issue, because how do you get it done politically is then the next question. How do you change minds? How do you change everyday habits? How far do you need to go to acknowledge what racism actually does? I've started to work with a colleague on the reception of Black Lives Matter in Germany, and our first inclination, and we haven't got any empirical data on this, but we're collecting newspaper articles and tweets and stuff and try and sift through this, is that it is often pushed away as, this is an American problem, this is not our problem, we have not been we're not colonial and slave traders, so this is their issue, not ours. We talk about Ausländer maybe and Ausländerfeindlichkeit, but not about race. We have not been racist since 45. It's really interesting that bit of acknowledging what is happening and which categories we're actually using and how we sometimes shift categories seemingly but actually don't. So that colleague, Heidi Ambruster in Southampton, has done some interesting stuff. She looked at pictures in Der Spiegel that had this subline Ausländer under it, and actually how that was racialized. It was very clearly sort of chosen Turkish immigrants that were clearly recognizable as Turkish. And never anybody else. So it's really in Der Spiegel, which is a sort of left-leaning newspaper, right? And that's the bit, sort of how do we deal with all these little categories that happen through the way we grow up and we start seeing the world, and how do we shift them, I think, is the difficult question. And I don't think Mills has an answer, but I don't think anybody does.
You're talking about, Michael, you're talking about sort of representation, right? Visual representation, often textual representation, that will allow us to shift perspective so that we can, shift politics at the end of the day, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a really interesting example you gave with the Ausländer, which means foreigner. in representations of Ausländer in German media. And again, you had to have a visual representation of that as a sort of markedly non-German, that is non-white body, right? Coming back to, in some ways, Whoopi Goldberg's idea that, you know, race is inscribed in the body, right? So when you see pictures of people suffering from the Holocaust, you don't see their race on their skin color, right? So there's an interesting quest, I guess, for all of us, if we are educators, if we are media people, or people who do podcasts, or anyone who is in the business of representation, needs to think about how we represent certain groups of people to perhaps, well, What should we do? Should we subvert these categories? Should we write Ausländer and then present a picture of a Danish foreigner in Germany or something like that, right? To subvert the imagery? Or what would be the sort of a solution, a very practical solution? You said Mills doesn't offer one in his philosophy, but what would be a solution when you design a module, or when you write a newspaper article, or when you put a Facebook post up? How do we subvert, or how do we change these perspectives?
Well, maybe humor, like you mentioned, but I think...
Andy... Is it really funny though? Because I think a Danish person living in Germany is a foreigner and should be treated like one.
Well, the problem is actually Danes. The problem is that they would not use that term against a Danish person, and that shows you how some of the racist categories work. I don't know. I'm very unsure what the solution is. I mean, there's some colleagues who work on race in Germany. I don't know if you heard of Susan Arndt, who really deliberately and consistently cross out any word that they deem racist or sexist. So they only use the beginning letter and then cross the rest of the word out to mark it out as this is a word that we must not use anymore. It's a very long list of words. I'm struggling with that idea sometimes, but on the other hand, I like it that it is marked and that it stops people in the reading track and makes them think, hang on a minute, do I agree with her? Is this a racist term? If it is a racist term, what other term could we use? Why is it so difficult to find another term for that? So I found that quite an interesting strategy.
Can I come back to humor quickly? So, I mean, that just sounds like a very kind of French suggestion of a solution, right? So it's like, it's almost pointing towards the absurdity of racism, right? And in a kind of Camus type sense. And this maybe is where I am more Kantian, because I would say that humor is part of the solution, possibly, in the right context. And it, you know, has to be in the right context, because there's the concern that you may make fun of something which really isn't very fun. Yeah. But I think humor serves a kind of icebreaking type context to just, you know, expose the absurdity of the situation that we find ourselves in. But we also need frameworks, you know, for actually addressing historically what's happened. And I think those frameworks need to include voices from the people who are oppressed themselves, you know. And I think that's something which Mills doesn't give us an answer, I don't think. He is exposing the issue. And the solution cannot be a European solution of white, you know, men again, you know, trying to say, so yes, how can you solve this? It would be impossible, wouldn't it? We need representation from the people, you know, from the individual histories of people who have been oppressed. And against, you know, Goldberg's initial statement, where it's an injustice of man against man, or the kind of middle statement, I guess, in that point, that you turn suffering into something which is homogenized and universal. It's very important to realize that different cultures and races have different histories of oppression and suffering. And the solutions to rebalancing those oppressions are going to be context specific. I'm involved in a couple of different projects, and one of them is looking at fungicide use in arable farming in Devon and Bristol. So farmers apply fungicides at certain parts of years or parts of the year onto their crops. Those fungicides seep into soils and get into water bodies, and they contribute to antimicrobial resistance. Yeah, so from a global health perspective, the danger is that those compounds building up either in soils or in water creates the opportunity for fungi to become resistant to those chemicals, azoles in particular. And we don't have very many of those chemicals which we currently use on farms. So resistance is starting to emerge. From a human health perspective, the problem is that the chemicals that we use in farming are also the chemicals that we use to treat fungal spore infections in humans. So if you get an Aspergillus infection in your lungs, for instance, they will give you essentially the same chemical that would be applied onto farms. So if you're unlucky enough to have an azole resistant spore of Aspergillus infecting your lungs, there will be no treatment and it will become a chronic health problem for you. So that's why we do the research. Our team is one of the kind of only people presently doing that research. And we are a group of biomedical scientists from Exeter and Bath, and human geographers from Exeter and Bristol. And I kind of got involved in that project in terms of building the stakeholder network. So it's not necessarily kind of a Kantian project, but it's one which draws from my background in philosophy, my background working for charities, to build a stakeholder network with independent organizations. So we work with farming associations, farmers, we work with river trusts, we work with water companies, and we work with a group of people called agronomists. Agronomists they're essentially soil scientists who are commissioned independently by chemical companies, and then farmers pay them for their advice and application of chemicals onto their farms. And it becomes quite a difficult relationship to manage between agronomists and farmers, because farmers feel that they might be being taken advantage of by agronomists, and agronomists in turn are dependent on farmers for their jobs. So it creates a very difficult status quo where they're both, you know, without the agronomists, our crops would fail under the current strategies of farming, where we do a lot of monocrop farming. But farmers are very reluctant, well, farmers and agronomists are reluctant to change their ways because it may affect the profitability of farms. But yeah, the more we use fungicides, the less effective they're going to be in the future. So that's the view of the project. Yeah.
Just to challenge you, this sounds to me like the perfect example of a social practice in which we're all equal. Are we all equal in farming, in adopting these methods, hopefully not encountering drug-resistant fungicides? Or does race, like Mills seemed to suggest, play a particular role? It permeates all our practices. What were your thoughts in that direction?
We're equally affected. Well, almost equally affected by the impact of farming. I would say that farmers are at more risk than other group members. So for instance, you know, farmers who farm potatoes for McDonald's, so I've heard, they have their fungicides, which they use on their potatoes to give them the shape and the color that they have. Some of those farmers won't go out onto those fields 3 days after application because they're so dangerous. Yeah. So in that sense, you know, we are all equal almost. But I would say that, so in terms of health or health implications, it puts us on a level footing. But in terms of the situation under which people find themselves in those situations, I'd say we're probably not equal. Yeah. So farmers, for instance, some of them will be generational farmers. They wouldn't have had the opportunities to go to university. They may have been involved in farms which have been profitable in the past, but now they're starting to run at a loss. And that's very different than farmers who, say, have got networks into local farm shops, are able to essentially convince someone to pay £20 for a chicken, you know, as opposed to the broader representation of farmers, of farmers who are dependent on the food networks that they already have. And they might feel trapped by those. You know, they can't sell their farms. People might not want to buy them. They can't leave their farms because they depend on them for the only thing they've ever known what to do. And it may be generational for them. And there's no immediate solutions to people who find themselves in those problems. So I do think there's higher and lesser degrees of autonomy which impact equality within my project on farming. So, and that's why you need the social science perspective, because our work is novel, because we have social scientists and pure scientists tackling this problem together. Because, you know, it's all well and good knowing that there's fungicides in water, which is not going away. And from our initial scoping work, we found fungicides in every single one of the sites that we tested. They weren't huge concentrations, but they were enough to be concerned. We subsequently found out that we don't even have proper risk assessments to understand how dangerous they are. So that's something to do in the future. But it's all well and good.
Scary.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really interesting, but it's still all well and good having that data. But unless you know the drivers and barriers to fungicide use, which are actually impacting farmers, which you can then take to politicians, you know, take to communities, there's no point in doing the research, really. You know, data just for the sake of it isn't going to help anyone.
So during the pandemic, we have seen that this little virus, COVID coronavirus, presumably attacks the human body in equal ways. It doesn't matter if you're black or you're white. But it has affected different populations in different ways. Now, in your project, Andy, you look at Devon and Bristol, as I understand, and I don't know much about the area over there. I assume the southwest of England, at least the agricultural world over there, is predominantly a white sort of business in that sense. If you took that project to another geographical context, let's say the south of Italy or the south of Spain or in Greece, where you have masses of migrant workers who work on farms from Africa, from India, from Pakistan, from Bangladesh, would you expect race to play out in a particular way in relation to these fungicides?
So in arable farming in the southwest, we still have pickers, or we did up until recently, you know, mainly European, Eastern European pickers. So maybe it's not race in the same way, but they're definitely, if those people are being exposed to fungicides, then there's a, you know, in the sense that, you know, with the pandemic as well, you know, frontline workers, you know, were disproportionately from other races, and they were bearing the brunt of the danger. For relatively little pay, you know, a lot of them were on, you know, 0 hours contracts, cleaners, things like that, and they're the ones who, even though it wasn't an explicitly racist policy, it was one that indirectly discriminated against people from certain races. And I would imagine it would be the same case for people in large farms who are having individuals on their farm, say picking or something like that. They'd be being exposed to those azoles much more frequently than other people would be, than the general public would be. So in that sense, it would indirectly have health impacts which would follow kind of, they track races in the same way. So it is indirectly racist, yes.
Michel, did you want to chip in here?
I did. Not my field, but something interesting came to mind talking about whether this is racist and whether the history of racism plays into this. I picked up something that Andy said earlier, saying, you know, as long as we do monocultures, there's a very, very interesting study. It's a bit older, but Seeing Like a State by James Scott, who describes how Western science has actually pushed these practices onto farming and city building and all sorts of different things in non-European contexts, completely ignoring local knowledge that has existed for centuries about how to grow crops other than in monocultures, which would allow you to not use these highly industrialized processes. So there's another dimension to it, not only who works in there now and who's exposed to this, but also how local knowledge at the time in the 19th century was infantilized as, oh God, this is disorderly. Why are they growing 3, 4, 5 things together? There's some very interesting quotations in that book. And I think so we also have the history again to address a bit like what we saw in Mill's approach to Kant in the same way. And I think that's interesting for the natural sciences to reflect on, because they often have a very almost a naive view of reality, as in if we can prove this, if we have evidence that fits our models, then it's right, and everybody who argues against this is sort of just not educated. And that was something that used to happen at that time. And I wonder if it still happens nowadays, where you say, you know, we have the better way of dealing with this rather than asking, why are you doing this? How is this happening? How does this work for you? And I think this is where the social sciences can actually have quite an impact, the qualitative ones, in packaging and communicating information from the bottom up rather than this constant thinking from above that we used to have. And that is quite linked to the type of white male rationality in the West. By the way, James Scott wouldn't talk about this in racist terms, but that, in racism terms, but I think that is the link. He thinks about more about the structure of society and the structure of knowledge in that case. But I think the link can be made.
Just building on that, when I talk with pure scientists and using humor as well, like we were talking earlier, I often say to them that, you know, science is the modern day colonialism. Yeah? So, and this is the reason why I say you need social science in your science, because if you're not asking questions about local communities and how they work, then you're completely blind to that in your science methodology. Yeah? So in our farming project, we're building relationships with colleagues in India. And it's really interesting trying to figure out what the similarities and differences between the two cultures, between the two soils, you know, all the different levels at which there will be dynamic relationships, how they change between the two cases, and trying to convince scientists that they need social scientists, not just at the end to promote it, but at the very beginning in the structure of the methodology, is something that is starting to get more awareness in academia, but it's definitely something which has been missing recently. You know, the social science is the appendage. It's not that they're not causal, it's that they it's that you need the social science narrative in order to have the complete picture.
Now, I just want to come back to morality and fungicides one last time. Like, so is it moral to put fungicides into the ground so that we have, I guess, better crops, more crops? Perhaps again, thinking about not the case of the UK, because we are a very overdeveloped country over here. We have enough to eat and we could also import some things. But looking at, for instance, since you mentioned India, what came to my mind was 1970s, the so-called Green Revolution, when there was a famine in India, lots of people were dying. There was no food on the table, literally. And India, the government of India decided to launch a large campaign with pesticides to grow the crops in a very fast way, to have like 4 harvests a year and to feed the country, right? Now that was great and it worked and the country, people had food on their tables again. And the problem is 40, 50 years later, the groundwater is sinking. And nowadays it's really, really difficult to grow anything in these places where these pesticides were used. So I'm thinking about the short term effects, the short term morality here to feed people, and the long term morality of perhaps destroying our planet. Yeah. How does your project approach these different temporalities in relation to morality?
I mean, it's hard to, I guess that's the point, is that we've been talking a bit about how appropriate Kantian ethics is for the modern day situations that we find ourselves in. And they're not usually trolley problems anymore, are they? They're not usually, you make a choice and one seems much simpler than the other. I mean, we live in industries of power, which are stratified in different ways, and they impact the kind of choices that we have. Historically, we're inheriting the problems of the land before us. So say like in India, for instance, you know, it's probably that there's more of a moral precedent to reduce fungicide use now than there ever has been, because you're contributing to a problem which is already compounded, right? But at the same time, it's necessary at the moment. Now, that's the problem, isn't it? Is that how do you shift from a system which is increasingly becoming more resistant, increasingly degrading soil health, creating problems for water, like you say, you know, because it's not so much the fungicides which are the problem for the water. It's the fact that you till your soil in order to, so you churn up your soil in order to dilute the concentration of fungicides, and in that you kill the soil health. Yeah, so you kill all the biodiversity in the soil, and you compact it. So when it does rain, that water doesn't go into the soils anymore. It runs off, and it creates flood risks and stuff like that. So, and that's, you know, again, like building into the larger communal responsibilities and problems associated with farming, and these are pressures for farmers to change. But on the other side, a lot of farmers don't know how to change. Like you say, it's no longer sustainable in certain parts of the world for farmers to change their practices, because it will cause famine either way. And these are global problems. You know, this is on a par with climate change. And even if we could solve all of that, we may still be creating antimicrobial risk for the use of fungicides, which will create superbugs, you know, analogous to what we had in the pandemic recently. But even, you know, research is drying up into these areas. So, you know, what one thing we had is that Exeter University, well, the GW4 in general, trained a lot of us to be very aware of problems associated with antimicrobial resistance. And the reason they did it was because pre-pandemic, they thought that that's where the funding was going. So if it were now, we'd have all these projects ready to go, you know, big global projects, lots of funding. And what's happened is that money never came to us because it got shifted away to pandemic research. And it's unlikely that it's going to come back. So, you know, in a post-pandemic era, we're less concerned about antimicrobial resistance than we ever have been, which is, you know, again, that's part of the responsibility. And so I think that morally, it's just such a complex web of issues, which no one really has any visibility on.
I'm afraid we have to leave it to this and move on to our final topic for today's discussion. And of course, everybody is talking now about something that we also cannot ignore, and that is the war in Ukraine. And even though Mills doesn't explicitly address the field of international relations in this essay, nevertheless, his critique of Kant can, of course, be discussed also in this context, and especially of two writings by our German philosopher, The Metaphysics of Morals, published in 1797, and his essay, a very important one actually, Toward Perpetual Peace, published in 1795. And why I mention these two writings, because in this particular period of his creative life, Kant presumably, and this Mills tells us, rejected his own previous racism. So he criticized colonialism and gave us writings that are presumably free from this lens. I'm not so sure about that. What I am sure of is that the current war in Ukraine challenges very much Kantian normative thinking about perpetual peace. And it has certainly reopened the debate on the causes of war. And in our in the context of our discussion, I think we can distinguish between material, more immediate causes, which do not pertain to this topic, and human nature. And we have talked a little bit about that. And I would like again to re-emphasize that Kant saw humans as governed both by reason, a topic that you have addressed quite extensively, Andrew, and the deterministic forces of nature. So man's unsocial sociability, says Kant in a different essay, Idea for a Universal History from a Cosmopolitan Point of View, drives him to seek the company of others while at the same time rejecting it. And states in international relations find themselves in similar relationships as men in the state of nature. So the only way towards perpetual peace, argues Kant, is by means of a gradual extension of a federation of rule of law abiding / republican states. This means practically, and here we have Kant's three definitive articles. One, that the constitution of a state must be republican, in other words, a Rechtsstaat. Two, that international law or the law of peoples should be founded on a federation of free states. And three, cosmopolitan right must be restricted to the conditions of universal hospitality. Kant's views on the war are also sometimes quite positive. War, from his perspective, helps humans. It helps humans test their limits, populate distant areas, and come into contact with each other. So I'm not quite sure how I can see the positive aspects of the Ukraine war at the moment. I also tend to think that his framework towards perpetual peace seems to have hit upon some obstacles, a very real one. And the question is, if this political project, if this Kantian political project to international relations cannot even be applied to Europe or to the other half of Europe, how can we expect it to be then applied to international relations more broadly, where we talk about different peoples, different cultures, and there's a lot more difficulty in finding a common resolution on wars, on conflicts, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. I think that when understanding Kant's views on war, we have to think about the diversity of types of war that there are, yes, and also the way that war has changed from the time that Kant was writing to how war is now. So Hegel, after Kant, described war as a battle between gentlemen, to not include, civilians, and there's that sense that this is just not the way that warfare is anymore. So in that sense, I think that we have to historicize war when we're talking about Kant's views on war, or historicize the technologies of war when we're talking about things, at least that now the technologies that we have are much more brutal than they ever were at the time, which Kant and Hegel were writing. Also, I'd like to draw attention to a book by Arthur Rippstein from last year called Kant and the Law of War. And that book was about applying a Kantian perspective to just war theory to show how catastrophic the consequences of war have been for morality, and how basically Kant's initial standpoint for almost all engagements in war are negative. They disrupt peace, especially Ukraine. So so from Rippstein's perspective, they're justified. I'm not trying to speak for him. He may disagree. He probably will speak about this at some point. He may have already. I don't keep up what he's doing, but I guess the general way that I would apply his work is to say that the Ukrainians are justified to use force in retaliation because what they're being threatened with is annihilation, right? And annihilation of a state should never be the pretext of war from Rippstein's perspective. Yeah. So in that sense, they are justified in the use of force in a way which the Russians are not, from that account. I think it's worth keeping in mind that, I think that my view of Kant's views on war, and also kind of aligned to Howard Williams, who's at Cardiff University, it's that idea that war is never good, and I think this is a Kantian sense, that this question about it's never something which is positive for morality. Yeah, so we can't go, it's morally good that Ukrainians are killing Russians. We can say, you know, we feel, you know, emotionally that this is the right thing to do, and Kant would say that other countries may be able to intervene in this war in a way that is at least in accordance with just war theory, you know, that they would be just in doing so under this circumstance. But the sense that it's the moral thing to do, or that there is a kind of morally good outcome of this, I think is something that from a Kantian perspective, from my interpretation of Kant, is just not possible. You know, that war, the default should always be that war is bad in all contexts, and to be avoided. But also, you know, in our current situation, it is an exceptional circumstance where there may be more appropriate things to do, right? So.
I'm just trying to get my head around the question of justification, because of course it also links to how a war started, and if you defend yourself, it's a very different story. The other question is of course the actions of the rest of the world in that situation, and the complexity that we have in sort of intervening or not intervening in this situation, because there's quite a lot of debate whether supporting this war even on the Ukrainian side is justifiable and is morally right, or if we're actually not doing enough is the other question, you know? And I think that shows you again, just because we're coming from discussing Kantian ethics, that you are then very quickly left on your own with a categorical imperative, because it becomes an empirical question, right? It becomes the complexity of what could happen if we intervened. How likely is it that this puts us at risk of nuclear war? How likely is it to lead to peace earlier or later? And these things are very, very difficult to predict. I mean, as we all know, if you look a bit into the history of war and peace, even sort of greatly educated military leaders have mostly miscalculated how their actions will affect the war. It's very rare that they had a plan and it went to plan, because the complexity of situations on the ground, of the various players in world politics. So I think we're coming away from a question of morality here and really a question of practicality. I'm pretty sure that everyone agrees we would like this to stop. But the question is, how do you end this, and how do you end it for good?
Maybe we cannot stop it. I mean, if we think that we have the deterministic forces of nature, Kant may show us, in a sense, the road towards peace. And he says it's the law. I would interpret it like this. We have to abide by the law. And if we do this in our domestic constitutions, eventually we will learn to be hospitable to each other and respect some sort of international norms, and therefore peace will come about.
I mean, you always have the debate about what is a Rechtsstaat? How far are we actually following this ideal? And sort of from a political science point of view, I would say in any democracy, you can find many elements that are not that. And not for bad will, actually, but sometimes also for just simply the complexity of the situation, the way law is set up, the way that historical precedents restrict us in what we can and cannot do. I mean, I always think the American Constitution must have been a great thing when it was written, but it doesn't work the same way anymore, and it now restricts us. So should we actually go back to unwritten constitutions? I mean, this whole argument of the constitutionalists, whether it's a good idea to have this written down. Well, if you have it written down, it's very difficult to change. The barriers are so high to change political structures, because I, at the moment, would argue there are many areas in US politics that don't resemble a Rechtsstaat. as in many other states, the one that I live in, the UK has similar issues. But of course, in terms of world and peace, if you look, I mean, the case for against Russia is quite clear, right? I don't think there's any much of a debate whether that is a Rechtsstaat or not. It's not. But then can you force somebody else to become a Rechtsstaat in your understanding of it? What does self-determination mean? I mean, we quite quickly back to our debate about racism and colonialism.
I would like now to somehow bring our lovely discussion to a conclusion. And for all of us, one final question. Can our philosopher Immanuel Kant still or again be a guide for modern times? Andrew.
So a difference between Kant and Hegel would be that Hegel thinks that the development of history is progressive, right? So it always has to be progressing. And this is a big problem for Hegelians because, you know, when things like wars happen, Hegelians basically, well, most of them bite the bullet and go, well, you know, it's all part of progress. You know, you don't see it at the moment, but it's going to become progressive in the future. I mean, maybe that's a bit of a caricature, but at least that's, that's the way certain Hegelians interpret his kind of view of history. Whereas I think that from a Kantian perspective, we have this choice about what ideals we want to adopt. And we can understand that sometimes, you know, we take a back step in terms of the development of enlightenment or reason. And it doesn't mean that we're condemned to fail. You know, it just means that we've stumbled on the ideals that we ought to collectively agree upon. I mean, I think it's also important to push back against the idea that we're in like a post-racist era. You know, I mean, it seems, well, from conversations that I've had with some Kantians, you know, the sense is that these discussions about Kantian racism have led us to have to address the fact that we still are working in racist, in a racist culture in a sense. And it's more about being open about that and being able to find ways to resolve racism where we see it in the same way that Mills is talking about, that we understand the history, we include the history in part of the conversation, rather than just say, well, it doesn't happen anymore, because it does happen in many different contexts. And I think that the only way we're going to get over it is if we address that and actually embed it in the moral frameworks that we develop from here.
Oh, absolutely agree. I think the deontological framework is a useful one and certainly progress, to use a Hegelian term or a Marxist term, against the historical predecessors in ethics. But the necessity is the awareness of what happens if we apply this empirically, and what circumstances do we live in, and then you get away from the discussion of the philosophy itself and need to look at what is race and how does it still govern us, and is it still relevant, and how is it relevant in the different local contexts, and then you can educate next generations about this and allow them to reflect and apply the ethical rules accordingly and change them. And I think that's the interesting bit in the Mills text, is to say, yes, that bit of the deontological framework is still applicable if we make sure we apply it to the empirical situation. And the analysis, the social analysis of what's happening now is what needs to change, and the historical acknowledgement of what led to this situation is what we need to fight for. So I, in that respect, it's a very useful and very strong argument that Mills brings forward.
I guess what you've said there, Michael, is really what is at the core of this podcast, namely that we need to look back into history to like have some sense of the future. And every generation needs to do this anew, needs to do that again. We can't assume, because Kant has been there for 250 years or something, that he's just there. We need to go and engage with his ideas and other people's ideas. And every generation needs to do that again and again and again. And that is how knowledge tradition works, I guess. And every generation will have a slightly different reading and a slightly different take, hopefully, on the books of the past. So with that being said, I thank you both very much, Andrew Jones, Michael Karnert, for joining us today in our podcast in the first episode, Critically Linked, How Past Books Shape Our Futures, in which we discussed Charles Mills' take on Immanuel Kant's moral philosophy. And I thank you both very, very much. Have a lovely day and take good care.
And stay tuned for our next episode.